Good afternoon. Welcome to Kitchener Today. It is Thursday, December the 2nd, 3 weeks away from Christmas Eve Eve. If that's a thing. Probably is for some people somewhere. I guess we could say it's, 20 days away from Christmas Eve Eve Eve. But that's going to get old in a hurry. It just did. Coming up a little bit later this afternoon, Scott Higgins, president of HIP Developments, will join us along with Paul Kaplish, the principal of Paul Consulting. They have put out a new book called The Joy Experiments. Be a different way of looking at how cities are built and the amenities that they have within them. David Leposky, the chair of Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act Alliance, he is a constant thorn in the side, I think, of the Ford government when it comes to opening up access to everyone in this province with disabilities. We'll chat with him just after one this afternoon. For-profit long-term care homes seem to be getting the bulk of new bed licenses. Is that what we want? Jim Stewart, chair of the Waterloo Region Health Coalition, will talk to us just after 1:30 this morning, and we'll continue our health train at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Of course, fingers crossed, Chief Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Kieran Moore, is set to provide an update on third doses. I might actually qualify. Somebody in my house already has a third dose. I might qualify very, very, very soon. He's no Doug Ford, so we expect that he will be on time. And Denise Young will join us just after 2:30 this afternoon as she collects blankets of love for the unsheltered. All that is coming up, but first. I'm telling you, I got out of Dodge just in time this morning. I really did get out of Dodge just in time this morning.
Lately, I've been baking bread. It seems a simple thing. A welcome for the day without a word.
It's one of those moments I wish I had
now
a hammer.
My heart
That's a horrible song, but it has to do with baking. And I left it just in time this morning as the bagel lady was losing her mind. She has taken a few months off from baking for people. But all of a sudden, she put out a post yesterday. Next thing you know, you're making a dozen bagels. I'm sorry, a dozen orders of bagels. And you're making chocolate chip cookies. And you're making dog treats. This is what my...
Hold on.
She makes her own dog treats.
She makes her own dog biscuits?
Yeah. Yep, we've even got a little cookie cutter that looks just like a
bone. There's recipes for that? I can find this online?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's all human food.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's wheat and honey and a couple of other things. Like, there's nothing disgusting in there. You could eat them yourself. I don't know that I ever could.
Could you make your own cat treats?
Sure. Absolutely.
All right. I know what I'm doing this weekend.
That would be probably very easy. Now, I don't know if cats would be the same as dogs. Because, cats like the fish and the stuff like that. So maybe you'd have to add something for that.
Yeah.
But the dog treats are, she says, the simplest thing in the world. And we've got a little cookie cutter that's the shape of a bone.
Dogs will eat anything that involves bacon.
True.
So just put bacon in it, and the dog will love it.
Yeah. Well, I see our cat every night gets like a quarter of a teaspoon of wet cat food.
What? Your dog eats a teaspoon of cat food?
A quarter of a teaspoon of wet cat food. This is actually a true story. Because a few months ago, for reasons that still haven't been completely explained to me, somebody decided, you know what the cat, after 11 years of existence, need? The cat needs some wet cat food every night. So she gets a couple of spoonfuls, and the dog is insistent that she get some, too. So she gets a quarter mixed in with her supper. She won't eat her supper unless she gets her little quarter teaspoon of cat food.
I thought Bear was fancy. We cook him scrambled eggs with his dinner. It's the only way he'll eat kibble these days.
Really?
Yeah.
Scrambled? You give your dog scrambled eggs and he likes them?
Yeah. Eggs are good for their coat.
Our dog loves scrambled eggs, too. She gets the occasional leftover.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Dogs eat all kinds of things. She likes carrots.
My cat likes chicken. Whenever we have a Swiss chalet and we bring it home, we always have to give the cats a little. They're clamoring for it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, they're predators, right? They would go out and kill chickens if they had. They would.
I know.
Cats are like that. So this baking is going on over the next couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And the place is going to smell fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And then this, I'm telling you, there's enough of this stuff that we have to get a little wheeled wagon and roll it around places to drop them off. It's really quite the enterprise. And I think it's probably going to cost me one of those new KitchenAid stand mixers at one point.
Because
the one she has is working overtime, and it's probably at least 12 years old. And it's, I'm pretty sure it's going to give up the ghost at one point. Because it is going for the entire day.
Wow.
Right? But keeps her busy.
And this is at home?
At home.
This is not like an industrial
mixer. There's no industrial mixer. There was some thought about that, but there's a lot of rules and regulations around that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just a nice thing to do for the cats and the dogs and the people and everything.
You know, the important.
Can you tell her to swing by my house? I could use a bagel.
That is one, two, three. That's four people so far this morning. I have spoken to her, but I have no control over the CEO of that particular corporation. Trust me on that.
Well, some exciting news to share with the two of you. The original house from Home Alone is now, well, will be available to book on Airbnb for one night only. So you'll have to be a lucky one to get in line on December 7th, following the release of the new Disney Plus reboot, Home Sweet Home Alone. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic.
Oh, it'll be
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Like, Home Alone was awesome. Home Alone 2 was okay. And then they got really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think actually they kind of jumped the shark on
Home Alone 2. Paulie, I really liked Home Alone 2. I thought it was really good. Anyways, the Chicago home will open its doors to fans for one night only on December 12th. Booking opens on December 7th at 1 p.m. Central Time, and it will be hosted by none other than Buzz McAllister. You'll know the older brother with the pet tarantula.
Yes.
Well, apparently they are offering a wonderful experience with plenty of Chicago's finest pizza, a candlelit dinner of microwavable Kraft macaroni and cheese,
ooh,
as well as a meet and greet with the tarantula.
Okay.
This can't be the same tarantula.
Look, I don't know how long do tarantulas live.
I don't know. I try to stay away from spiders. So, they freak me out.
Hold on. Does it say who the pizza is going to be?
No, it just says Chicago's finest.
Okay, because if it can only be Little Nero's, because that's the pizza in the movie that Macaulay Culkin orders.
I am
Little
stunned
Nero's
that you know
pizza.
That.
Wow. You're not one for pop culture, so I'm shocked that you know that also.
That's pretty impressive.
I'm going to see, actually, if this even is a real place.
They don't have Macaulay Culkin's not coming, right?
No. It's just going to be Buzz McAllister, and then you'll also get a take-home Lego version of the Home Alone house.
That's kind of cool.
The thing is,
that is pretty cool.
That house only would have been used for external shots. There's no guarantee the house is going to look anything like it does on the inside.
Yes, it does. I can see the listing on Airbnb right now. The photos. This is the actual house.
No, but I mean, they filmed the movie in the house, not just for the external shots?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. I'm looking at photos of the inside right now. It's the actual house. It's the exact same layout. Look at, here's the staircase.
Right.
There you go.
I see it. The staircase leading out to the front door.
Yes.
Where you can go tobogganing. Will they allow you to go tobogganing out the front door?
I don't know. It says you can get up to all kinds of mischief. Just don't let the tarantula on the loose.
So I my question is, like, this would be really good if Macaulay Culkin showed up, but does he have some thing about that? Like, he doesn't want to be associated with it anymore?
I honestly don't know. They don't get too much into that.
It's just
being hosted by Buzz, which you'll remember, nobody really liked Buzz in that movie.
Hold on, but Macaulay Culkin did an adult remake spoof of that a few years ago, did he not? Like, I think he embraces the whole Home Alone thing.
Or does he? He's a little weird.
Yeah.
Aren't we all, though?
Actually, he's a lot weird.
We're all a lot weird.
Well, yeah, we've all got a little something going on, but he seems to have a lot. Well, that's, I don't know. So you just go for the night? That's it?
Yeah, it's just one night only on December 12th. Yeah, you have to book it through Airbnb.
I want to sleep in the attic.
It doesn't say how much it costs. It just says that the booking will open on December 7th, and
That's very strange.
Mm-hmm. I think it'd be cool, though.
I don't understand. I've never really understood the love for Home Alone. It never did anything for
me. Really?
No.
Oh my gosh. I love that movie. I could watch it like every year around Christmas time and not get sick of it.
No, it's kind of in your wheelhouse though at the time. Yeah, I felt like I was forced to watch it.
Oh, okay.
Right? Because, okay, we can do this for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And any movie that I felt like I was forced to watch, I didn't really enjoy. So that's on me. It's not on anybody else. Hey, this is exciting.
You can't stop my happiness because I like the way I am.
Brittany knows this song.
I just can't stop my knife and fork when I see a Christmas hill.
And she knows who's singing it.
Yes.
Right?
John Travolta singing it.
It is. John Travolta from Hairspray. Which actually fits into my pantheon of one of my favorite Broadway shows, would be Hairspray.
Yeah.
The original, which I'm sure you probably never saw.
No, I haven't seen the original.
Wasn't as attracted to that one as this version.
Is Hairspray Good Morning Baltimore?
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen that. I don't think I've seen the John Travolta version.
No, it's the same version.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's the same version. So it's the one with all the people in it.
Mm-hmm. John Travolta plays the mum in Hairspray,
yes.
Polly.
Oh, okay. Yes, I do remember that now.
And I mentioned that because we are going out tonight to the theater.
Ooh.
That's how you say it in Kentucky, to the theater or the theater, as we say it up here. This is at the St. Jacob's Theater. We'll go to see A Closer Walk with Patsy Cline.
Ooh.
Just a closer walk with thee.
Now, is it just like a mock performance, or is it like literally a play around her music?
There's a story around her music because of her life and her untimely death and all those things that happened. And look, I'm not a huge Patsy Cline fan, not at all. In fact, there's a radio station that's near Bayfield that, as recently as 2 years ago, 3 years ago, would play a Patsy Cline song and then a Katy Perry song.
Oh,
back to back.
The 60-year musical gap. Like, that's pretty impressive.
Now, that's variety.
No kidding. You want to talk about today's best variety?
Yeah.
That's the only thing missing, you know, was the occasional Edison cylinder being played on there. Now, they're out of that now, so they play new country, which means you play the same 8 songs all day long.
Ah, yes.
But they would play Patsy Cline. and I've always been amazed at the longevity of that, because when you think about it, the demographics, you know, the people who grew up with Patsy Cline's music, many of them no longer exist. Sad to say. But so we're gold because my wife likes the old timey country music.
Mm-hmm.
But I am a huge fan of Hairspray. That's one of my favorite shows. I've mm-hmm. always liked Chicago. Mm-hmm. Now, you're a Broadway show person.
Yes, yeah.
It's your favorite.
Hairspray would be right up there. I also have been a fan of The Phantom of the Opera, although I have not seen it live, which I would really like to do.
I think that would be a very good show. Paulie, mm-hmm. you're not so much into it, right?
I don't mind it. We're actually going to a show.
Ew. To the theater?
This weekend. It's based on one of the characters in Alice in Wonderland.
Okay.
We went to a movie last weekend, and they ran a commercial for it before the movie. And I think it's in Cambridge.
Is it the Mad Hatter?
Yes, that's it. That's him.
All right, well, that'd be pretty good.
So, yeah, we're doing that this weekend.
I've seen a few good ones. I've seen a couple of bad ones. Lord of the Rings was a stupid play. It was almost
essentially
one night only. I think it closed after one night in Toronto.
They did a play on that? Aren't those movies very long?
Yeah. Well, the books are very long.
Yeah.
Books are very long and complicated. The movie is long and complicated, but you could do things on a movie. Not mm-hmm. sure you can do Tolkien's masterpiece in 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
And I know you shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other thing I discovered about that. All of a sudden, you've got elves singing and gnomes and hobbits and everything. So, oh, it's fabulous.
Yeah.
It doesn't work for a musical. Sorry. Just doesn't do it. Jersey Boys was one of my favorites.
Never seen that one.
That's a really good. It's Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, which mm-hmm. you have no idea. They were all in the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. You know what I just saw they're redoing or is coming out soon is it's a reboot of the West Side Story.
With Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Doing the directing. My wife saw that ad on TV the other night, and mm-hmm. she said, we should go. And I said, well, we did see West Side Story at Stratford.
Mm-hmm.
It has some very iconic music in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, though, very little musical in those trailers.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you kind of don't tie Spielberg to a musical.
Mm-hmm.
Unless, you know, it's the Darth Vader story. Terry, go ahead.
Hey, Brian. I just found something that you said interesting. You said about Patsy Cline.
Yeah. What a shock, wow. Terry. You said interesting.
Oh, my God. Anyway.
Stop the presses.
you were saying that most people that followed Patsy Cline are not with us anymore.
I said who grew up in the time of Patsy Cline. There's a difference.
Anyway, it's funny you said that because I've noticed on satellite radio in the last little while, they eliminated the 50s and the 60s music stations.
Yeah, well, that happened to a lot of what they used to call oldie stations. They took the 50s and 60s out of it and jammed it into the 70s and 80s, so...
I get it. If you grew up in the 50s, yeah, I think you're pretty much long in the tooth now if you're not with us anymore. But come on, this is late 60s, some of the psychedelic stuff. I think a lot of people are still around to listen to that, unless there was no demand on satellite radio. But, yeah, I miss them anyway. But, yeah, that's what caught my attention when you said that. I kind of concur with you, sir.
Thanks, Terry. Patsy Cline appeared on Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts in 1957. So that's 64 years ago. And she passed away in March of 1963 at only the age of 30. And I think that's why that's why it lasts.
I had no idea.
Right? Because it has that that tragic nature of it. That's why it just continues to go on and on and on over the years. So my wife will probably love it, and I will be there. And I'll like the performances too. It's just the music's not a great thing for me. Now, my favorite new musical is The Greatest Showman.
Oh, yes. That one is really good. And I actually, Jake wasn't too sure if he wanted to sit down and watch that one. And then I made him. And then he really liked that one.
You pinned him to the chair and forced his eyelashes open.
Yeah.
Well, and the part where Wolverine comes in. No, that doesn't happen. It's if you've never seen Hugh Jackman perform musical theater, mm-hmm. then you'd probably be surprised at Hugh Jackman performing musical theater. Mm-hmm. But he's an incredibly, incredibly talented person.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like he's more than just those plutonium blades that come out of his knuckles. Those aren't real, by the way.
No, they're not.
Fiddlesticks. No. Anyway, I'm interested to go see West Side Story because I want to mm-hmm. see what Spielberg does with it. Mm-hmm. If there's an alien in a bike, I'm going to be upset because that's not in the original story. They were not in the Jets.
Wasn't that E.T.?
Right. But I don't know what Spielberg's up to these days. Maybe he's somewhat confused. Maybe you throw E.T. into a bike at the end and both the rival gangs get together and love breaks out and everyone dances in the street. What could be better? This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. And see, Brittany, you just brought up another one that you're not supposed to like, and that's Moulin Rouge,
mm-hmm.
which I actually thought it was pretty good. It has moments. I like the way that it took music that you were familiar with and kind of built it in mm-hmm. to the whole story. It was over the top and cheesy,
yes,
but still had its moments. James, go ahead.
Did you say that, I didn't really catch what you said about West Side Story. Did you say it looks good?
It does, yeah.
I mean, the trailer that I saw, maybe it was just a bad rushed mix or something, but it just looked like bad lip syncing on one of the sequences. wasn't why I was calling, but, you know, you kind of put that in my ear. Did you ever see The Producers?
Oh, The Producers, yes.
Did you see it in New York?
I didn't see it in New York, no. Did you?
I was lucky enough to see it when Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick were doing it.
Oh, it was
absolutely phenomenal.
Springtime.
And then, fun fact, if you ever saw the film Birdman,
yes.
With Michael Keaton, that's the same theater that they had The Producers at, was where they filmed that movie.
Did you ever see the original Producers?
No.
Oh, go back to that one with it's Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner.
Oh, you know what? I have. Yeah, that's right.
You know what? It's not nearly as good. It really isn't, but it's a very funny show. Thanks, James.
Have a good day.
Have you ever seen that, Brittany?
No.
We've reached a point in this world that I can't sing the main song from that on the radio.
Oh. Okay.
No. It is so incredibly politically incorrect in some ways.
Oh, boy.
But it's actually, it is a really good show and really started off Mel Brooks, you know, into what he was doing. So it's worth watching. If you'll probably be offended at some point, but... It's kind of what theater's supposed to do from time to time. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Now is the time to seize the day.
Now is the time to seize the day.
Send out the call and join the fray.
Send out the call and join the fray.
Bonds will be righted if we're united.
Let us seize the day.
I will let you in on a couple of little secrets. A little secret number one is we have tickets to give away at 2:45 this afternoon, which are to next week's Teddy Bear game involving the Kitchener Rangers. And today we will have, I thought it would be next week, but here's the thing. I wasn't paying attention to what Brittany said yesterday, so I missed this part. However, she was good enough, so you will hear the piano stylings of Brittany Bordelon this afternoon at 2:45. All you have to do is identify the song and play along with whatever foolishness we decide to throw into it at the time. Here's another little secret. Sometimes when you sit around city council tables, not everything is maybe the most interesting you might think, but there are certain things that grab your attention. And I go back on that a few years with an appearance by Scott Higgins, the president of FIP Developments, who sat in front of council and explained his vision for the spot on which the old post office sits in Waterloo. Not the old post office, the old post office, which would be a residential section, then with several floors of STEM outlets, science, technology, engineering, and math, and really a space to bring the bottom part of a building alive. And that always stuck with me. And I had a chance to have coffee with Scott a while after that, just considering the whole discussion. And then we got the banana statue, and now we have a book, The Joy Experiment. Scott Higgins is the president of HIP Developments, and Paul Kapflisch is the principal of Paul Consulting, and they both join us this afternoon. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good.
Hey, Brian.
Scott, things are well, I hope.
Always. Never a dull moment.
No. Days. Well, that's your fault. So why'd you decide to get this out here now?
I'll jump in and sure. Say that, you know, now wasn't necessarily the reason for doing it. But it certainly is kind of right for the time. We started off, Scott started talking about wanting to come up with a bit of a manifesto as to why, to explain why HIP does what it does and why it spends a lot more time and effort and money on things that they don't necessarily get asked to do for the sake of the community and city building. You know, a handful of words or some corporate poetry really wasn't cutting it, and eventually we just felt that the vision was big and it really needed a book to do that.
So, Scott, if you have to, because I'm going to make you, if you have to wrap up, you know, the vision in this book, what is it, if there even is a vision at this point?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, Brian. I think the it's an exploration more than a dictation, I would say, and that's purposefully why we called it the Joy Experiment. But look, we ought to start talking as a society about how do we come together? How do we have more fun? I fundamentally think cities are going to compete with cities for talent. We already do. The days of just practical infrastructure investments as a means to attract people or industry are dead. People can pick where they want to live. And I think the augment of COVID and work from home mentality is just poured jet fuel on that scenario. And so this was trying to encourage a conversation in the community of treating joy as a practical outcome. How do we make investments in strangers meeting strangers in a public place and understanding that they're not that strange a priority in civic investment, not just roads and sewers and practical things? How do we start treating the human spirit of our city as a fundamental investment plank, both in the private sector and in the public sector? And if we do that well, I think the city will become a lot more fun. And if the city's a lot more fun, then a lot more people want to move here. And when a lot more people want to move here and bring their creative talents and ideas, you know, all of a sudden industry wants to be attached to those people. So it's just changing the recipe on a go-forward basis as to what we consider, you know, fundamentally important in city building. And I think joy, you know, needs to make its way to the forefront.
And it's really about bringing life to that ground level, right? Beyond the patios, which anybody can do, but bringing life to a street so that when I walk down King Street at 7:30 on a July evening, there's life there. There's not just stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the concepts in the book is the idea of free streets. You know, a simple notion, can we make our streets free? Because anywhere where a pocket of free or cheap real estate is available, interesting things happen, right? That was Soho, moves to Brooklyn, moves to Detroit. If you can create cheap real estate where somebody that's running a small business or wants to do an experience or wants to create some art, the things that fuel the experiences in our city, the fun in our city, you know, they can't pay $40 a foot. They can't have a big rent burden over their head. And, you know, we've got an interesting concept of how we just reshuffle the deck of these condominium towers to create infinitely protected free space. And you know, to give that space to the people that otherwise, if we just charge $40 in rent and it's a for lease sign or it's another multinational tenant that's the same as in Hamilton and every other city, I mean, what's the defining culture of Kitchener-Waterloo? not much. If we can give free space away and allow small businesses, entrepreneurs, artists, and creative people to do their thing, boy, that's a pretty fun city. So, we just explore concepts like that in the book and show how they can work if we get a little less rigid and a little more creative with our planning policies, with how we approve things to get developed in the city. And personally, I think, developers have a role to do that. I mean, our legacy isn't going to be measured by how much money we can make. It's going to be measured by what impact we had in the city. And we got to start doing things a little different to have a better impact.
And are we seeing, I guess, from both, because both of you are involved in this industry, are we seeing a little bit of movement towards that?
Yeah, I mean, Paul, you can talk too, but I think yes, Brian. I know so many local developers that, if you sort of shake the reputation of this big bad developer that comes from a different area and doesn't care about the city. There's so many local developers, younger developers that are, that were raised here, that have a family and are raising their family here and are taking their position of privilege of running a big development company, seriously, and trying to think, well, okay, maybe, one of the items in the book deals with social capitalism, right? We call it shitty capitalism, is sort of, pardon the language, but we've almost morphed into that. We need to come back to social capitalism. Like, why a business only succeeds on the ecosystem that it plays within. And if all we do is take from that ecosystem and we never get back to it, the ecosystem's going to die. Nature teaches us that. Why don't we just continue to invest in the city in a different way and maybe make less on each project, but try to make the city better. As a result, the city will grow and prosper. And as a result, our companies will build that growth and prosperity. So it's a simple equation that I think a lot of local developers are starting to gravitate toward.
I think, I work with several developers, and I think that Waterloo Region is very blessed by having developers like Scott and some of the other ones that Scott, is talking about, Momentum or Zero Group. People who want to create space that actually contributes to our cultural identity. So as you mentioned, Brian, that, it's not just stuff. There's something else happening there, and that a lot of thought gets put into the curation of these spaces so that they contribute to who we think we are and help advance ways of getting together and start to, Scott mentioned playing with strangers. Given the state of society in terms of division at, nationally, provincially, locally, families, everything, we're sliding to this continual division. How do we get out of that? How do we get out of the isolation that often technology allows us to fall into? A lot of that comes down to something as simple as playing with strangers and in public. And playing with strangers may sound like a simple thing, but, if you create interactive areas and spaces, the funny thing happens is before you know it, you're doing something, you're playing, you're laughing, and the person beside you is playing and laughing, and they don't look like you, sound like you, or think like you, and yet you're getting along, and play disarms us in a way that we can come together. And if you do that play in a way that also contributes to what we think about ourselves and how we identify our community as a community, that's really a fundamental building block that we really need a lot right now. And I think Waterloo Region is pretty blessed to have these developers who are saying, we like this idea, we like contributing in this fashion, and we want to get involved in doing it, because it's not something that just the public, it's unfair to sort of say, well, city halls, you must do these sorts of things. They can't on their own. And it's going to be the future is a collaboration between private, public, institutional, and social sectors. And I think I personally think we're pretty lucky in the region to have some elements of the private sector, especially in the real estate development space, quite prepared to step up and say, let's start building the types of cities we need for the future.
And this is more than just what we've certainly seen in the past few years, which is, residential on top, commercial and retail on the bottom. It's more than that.
Yeah, no, I think it's a lot more than that. It starts with, that concept's trying to create the space for freedom and the space for creativity, but it goes much beyond that. Like, if you want to be an inclusive city, Ken Greenberg always said it best, how much fun can I have in your city for free? That's the measure of a city. I mean, it kind of is, right? And we build these things, like we build our houses with backyards for a private amenity. We build municipal amenities, a lot of which are private pay models. You know, what are we building where someone can just go have fun for free? And if you really want to be an inclusive city, it shouldn't be how much money you have equals how much fun you can have. You know, maybe we should reprioritize that deck. And a lot of these concepts are proven out in places like Denmark and across, you know, most of Scandinavia, where they built communion again. They, you know, faith became the community, not an institution. And as a result, they can tackle some of the challenges. You're not going to tackle climate change unless you can bring the community together to try to tackle it collectively. And so if you can invest in these public places, you can have fun with strangers, the city can prioritize investments to create things that people can do for free. What that does is bring community back together. As soon as you bring community back together, you can start to tackle the hard things that we need to tackle. You're not going to do it until you get community to realign. And I think, you know, there's so much noise and division that happens out there right now, in particular through the process we're all going through. I mean, we need to slow that down and come back and remember that we're all part of one big community. And if we can find places to interact with each other, encourage those conversations, all of a sudden strangers become friends en masse. And then you want to tackle the hard challenges of some of the things that face society. You can tackle them because you're working together again. And, you know, that's basically the idea behind some of the placemaking and urban placemaking projects we're doing, is to at least start to create those spaces where the community has an opportunity to get to know each other a little bit better.
The book is called The Joy Experiments. Tell me about the Joy Award.
Well, in our book, we talk a lot about some of other projects that people do, or even we use HIP projects as examples of a backdrop. And a lot of them have sort of significant dollar price tags attached to them. But we also wanted to make sure that people understood that building a joy experiment doesn't necessarily have to cost a lot. And in our community, in the Warley region, throughout COVID, there's been this wonderful project called Behind the Mask. And a woman named Brenda Reed had developed this project where people were asked to take cloth, make our typical COVID mask, and then write or draw or do something that expressed how they felt. And now that was then put into a quilt, and now it's on display throughout the region. I think at the moment it's at the Stanley Park Community Center. And we just thought that was really beautiful, and we thought that should be identified and celebrated. And then we thought that, you know, joy is something that should be celebrated everywhere. So we came up with the idea of creating joy awards that we will give to people within our region who we think are capturing the essence of joy, or even in other communities around, you know, around the country, around the world. The Joy Award is something to celebrate that. So Brenda was our first Joy Reward recipient. Her project cost a few, you know, very little to do. It cost participation from the community, and it's a beautiful and joyful thing. And it makes people sort of say, it puts a smile on people's face. It makes people think, and it makes people feel like they're connected to something. And so as part of publishing the Joy Experiments book, we are sort of signing up to create Joy Awards and give them out to people who are don't even know they're doing such a thing as a Joy Experiment until we tell them it aligns with our philosophy.
Does all this mean that I can move closer to my giant animal statues, Scott? Because that's always been important.
I was going to bring that up, right? I think you were on this strategy 4 years ago in Waterloo Park, and someone vetoed you. But absolutely, you should continue to advocate. What was it—a duck or a squirrel?
I think a goose with a number of boulders behind it to tell us exactly what a giant goose would do. I think that's a start, and then I think we get the giant blackberry up at the Research and Technology Park.
Yeah. You know, but those moments of just some levity in the day, right? The days get long, the days get heavy. You know, and I know just in listening to your show, you're a big proponent of humor to deal with issues and to talk with things. I mean, but it's true. You put a smile on somebody's face, all of a sudden their day gets a little bit brighter. You know, you do that en masse across the community. You start to focus on the things that make us happy instead of the things that make us sad or divided, and watch what happens, right? So it's a simple premise, long been proven successful, and all we're trying to do is inject it into city building conversations with a little practicality that, you know, the dollars and cents need to get reallocated in some way, both private and public, to focus on a happier community. And if we do that, we're going to succeed as a community.
Scott, Paul, thanks for your time today.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Scott Higgins and Paul Kapflisch. The Joy Experiments is what it's called. And it really does talk about, you know, when you go out into a city and you just don't feel that vitality that's there. This is no disrespect to Uptown Waterloo, but there are times, many times, when you can go through there and it's just, there's just no life to it. And we have this tremendous opportunity as we continue to develop up the spine of Kitchener-Waterloo, that long stretch of King Street, to be able to add things to it. And they really, they don't cost a lot of money. They don't have to cost a lot of money. And just adds a little bit of happiness. So I think when you if you perhaps have ridden the Ion into Uptown Waterloo, when you get out, you see something that makes you smile, you feel better about your place, you feel better about your hometown, and you may tell someone. And then because, as Paul and Scott rightfully point out, we have reached an age where you can work almost from anywhere, having that little bit of joy is a great thing. When we were in Amsterdam, they very conveniently put an outdoor exercise station, no charge, right opposite the cheese shop. So you can go in and have your cheese, and then you can go and work off your calories in some kind of fun, whimsical things. We were at the Dublin Zoo, and a simple thing is this. There's a sign on one of the enclosures that says, you know, please do not climb the walls of the enclosure in case you fall in because you don't taste that good to the animals. So let's have a little fun. Quit taking everything so darn seriously, to quote the Joker. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
So this was trying to encourage a conversation in the community of treating joy as a practical outcome. How do we make investments in strangers meeting strangers in a public place and understanding that they're not that strange a priority in civic investment, not just roads and sewers and practical things? How do we start treating the human spirit of our city as a fundamental investment plank?
Scott Higgins, the president of HIP Development, says, sitting having a coffee with him 4 or 5 years ago, we started off talking kind of jokingly about the giant statues, and he told me he had plans for the banana statue in front of the old, circa 1877, I think, the building, in not too far from Uptown Waterloo, where the old brick brewery used to be. And we kind of laughed about that, and then lo and behold, there's the giant banana statue, and It is one of those things that kind of makes you stop for a second and just take a look. And so the idea is, I will tell you that at when you're sitting in front of a development proposal at council, it is often so much about the technical aspects of it. And they're important, don't get me wrong. You know, the movement of traffic, the parking often becomes a very large issue. And in many of the developments that are being built today, and this has been a pretty big change over the years. It's taken us a while to get there. But in most cases, we are building some commercial, some retail on the bottom, maybe even on the top, on the bottom two floors. And then above that is residential. But there are a lot of buildings where amenities are put in for the residents of those buildings. And the interaction, the outside part of it, isn't really all that important. And that street level experience that you'd like to be able to have, which gives your city more life. And we spend so much time really focusing on provincial and federal issues, which they have virtually no impact on your city and the view you have of it from your neighborhood. Sure, they put some money in place, but it's the design, the look, all of that stuff falls onto the local council and the local developers. And to Scott and Paul's credit, they're not just talking about, you know, councilors changing their mindset, who I find generally are more than happy, you know, to okay a building that might be a little bit different, which adds something new, like some kind of outdoor space, accessible space, all those things. But they also talk about the development industry needs to do the same thing. And how do you make that balance between making the money that we do in this capitalist system and also making sure at the end of it that we don't just end up with this canyon of tall buildings which provide nothing except shelter. Not that shelter isn't important, but it doesn't provide any real sense of neighborhood. And, you know, the area that I was familiar with for a long time, which is at King and University, just around from Waterloo Collegiate Institute. And when I first started driving to that particular office, well, everything there was essentially your one or two level, really wartime houses in many ways. And that has changed dramatically over the years. If you haven't been up there in a long time, go. There's some interesting design. So that is how part of it has been changed. And if you look back to what we had before, you know, some of those maybe three-story walk-ups, things like that, design wasn't really an aspect of it. So it's a change that kind of brings everybody, you know, to a certain place where, like they say, you can have a little bit of fun, you can smile at something. You know, why do we think things like the Wonders of Winter or the lights display in Victoria Park are so popular? Because it provides a little something different. It provides, as they say, a little bit of joy in what might otherwise, in some cities, be a very joyless experience. They make the point on their page, because you can go to the Joy Experiments, and I should say the joyexperiments.com, and you can order the book there if you like. But they make the really strong point that 100 cities are responsible for most of the economic, cultural, and innovative activity in the world. The cities that invest in infrastructure that supports the inventive human spirit will succeed. The cities that don't will unquestionably fade. And not every city has the opportunity that we have with all of this development, all of this change. The natural progression of how a city looks is playing out right in front of us. You cannot do that in a whole lot of other places. So take advantage of it. I often laughingly refer to the giant animal sculptures, except I'm not laughingly referring to them. I'm saying we bring that kind of thing in here, and people with far more creative and humorous minds than mine will come up with the right idea for it. But those kinds of things that make you stop for just a second and say, cool, I kind of like this. That's what we should kind of be working towards. Tickets to give away this afternoon. Well, not giving them away. You have to earn them, because that's the way this show works. But as long as you know your piano, your piani, Brittany Bordelone will tickle those ivories for you. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Talk to me. Talk to me. Ooh, I love the things you say. Talk to me. Talk to me.
Coming up a little bit later on this afternoon, the Ford government is looking to parcel out 30,000 new long-term care beds over the next few years. And it appears that for-profit long-term care homes are getting the bulk of those new bed licenses. Jim Stewart, the chair of the Waterloo Region Health Coalition, will join us just after 1:30 this afternoon. And we are, fingers crossed, waiting for the Chief Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Kieran Moore, to provide an update on third doses for an expanded number of Ontarians. The information, so well, seems to be already at least partially on the table, and that will expand those third doses to those over the age of 50. But we will check in with the CMOH at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Right now, though, years of government foot dragging, and still some 2.5 million people in this province with disabilities still won't be able to access public spaces in the province. David Lepofsky is the chair of Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act Alliance, joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon.
Well, I guess, does this mark the official start of the election campaign? I know it already started from the party side a while before, but you're getting out in front of this.
We're trying to get out in front. The Disability Coalition I lead, which is nonpartisan, wrote all the parties to ask for their election commitments on what they will do if elected to make Ontario accessible to people with disabilities. Now, we fought for 10 long years, from 1994 to 2005, to get a law passed to deal with this. And we won. We were ecstatic in 2005 when the legislature passed unanimously the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. And that law requires the provincial government to lead this province to become accessible to people with disabilities by 2025. Now, at the time we won it, there's some people in our community who said, that's too long, 20 years, you know, we need it done sooner. And I understood that, but we said, we got to give them the time to get the job done. The problem is we've come to realize after years of trying to get the government to do its job and lead us to the promised land that we were promised, that as of now, with 2025, just a little over 3 years away, after all this foot dragging and failures by our one provincial government after the next, we're not going to get there on time. We've made some progress, there's no question, but progress has been too slow. So in a nutshell, we've said to the parties, we are devastated that what we were promised is not being delivered. And we want to know your plan to fix this up, to get us as close as you can to accessibility by 2025. And to get us to the promised land that we were promised as soon after that as we can. We're not saying, hey, they didn't succeed, so, you know, you can just forget it. It's all done. We're going home. We're saying we've been betrayed, and we want to know what each government party will do about it. They voted unanimously for the law back in 2005. We'd like them to be unanimous now about fixing it.
So what, Cal, help us understand, David, what's missing in terms of accessibility? What has been left out? Is it possible to quantify it in that way, or is it too wide-ranging?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So first, in terms of our daily experience of people with disabilities, an independent review released almost 3 years ago by our former Lieutenant Governor, David Onley, said that Ontario remains a place that is full of, what his words, soul-crushing barriers, and that progress on accessibility has been too slow. We're not just talking about buildings. We're talking about a third of a million students with disabilities in our schools. They get some things, but not what they need. We're talking about patients with disabilities who face too many barriers in our healthcare system, job seekers and employees with disabilities who want competitive employment. Some have succeeded, but others face too many barriers. Now, again, we're not saying nobody's doing anything, but that leads me to point number two. What we need to get us there was what we were promised, which is the government was required to pass a series of regulations called accessibility standards that will tell government offices and school boards and hospitals and private organizations what they need to do and when they need to do it by. And some were passed, but nowhere near enough, so that obligated organizations aren't being told what they need to do. And they're not getting the guidance. We're not getting the protections. And what's been passed is too weak. And point number three, government after government, minister after minister, where there are new requirements, have done an abysmal job of enforcing them. So they're not being taken seriously. Now, some listening to you are probably thinking, hey, I want to have an accessible place. I want customers with disabilities. I want employees with disabilities. That helps my bottom line. The government is failing them because it's not providing them the directions of what needs to do so that they don't each have to reinvent the wheel and figure it all out themselves.
So the question comes to my mind, David, is what would be the barrier here to all of this being done? Because, first of all, I can't imagine that there's anybody against the idea of accessibility. That just doesn't seem right. So is this just a monetary issue?
No, it is not a monetary issue, because if you do accessibility right, you save the public money and private businesses will make more money. Because we get more people with disabilities out of social assistance and into jobs. We get more customers with disabilities at private organizations. And you get a bigger pool of competent employees waiting to get jobs who can get jobs. So it's not a cost issue. David only got it right in his report that was released that he delivered to the government in January of 2019. But the government still hasn't released a plan to implement it. What he said is it's been a failure by one premier after the next to make this a priority, to direct his cabinet, I want this to happen. We voted for this. Now let's make it happen. And that's not, we're nonpartisan. I'm not pointing at any one premier. It's all of them. Now, I will tell you, things were problematic before Doug Ford became premier, but he's actually made things worse. For one thing, he put his foot on the brakes. We're going too slow, and he slowed us even more. But also, his government has actually made things worse by creating new barriers. One example, our sidewalks. Well, it's hard enough to get around. There's enough clutter out there for facing people in wheelchairs, people like me who are blind and others. But the Doug Ford government solution has been to unleash electric scooters on us, driven by uninsured, unlicensed, untrained people who create a silent menace facing us and others, making our sidewalks more dangerous than they were before the Ford government. That's just one example. I could give you lots of others. But what we've done, it's not enough to complain, though we got lots to complain about, being betrayed on this major commitment that the legislature made, violated, you know, the government failing to live up to its legal obligations. That's bad enough. But what we've done is we've written all parties with a detailed plan. We've come forward with what they need to do to fix it. We'd like all the parties to sign on to this before the election. But also we'd like Premier Ford, who's in power now, to take the last 10 minutes, probably the last 6 months, I should say, of this term in office, to take his foot off the accelerator. I misspoke completely. Take his foot off the brake. I apologize. And put it on the accelerator and start doing his job.
The question pops, because I'm a bit of a cynic, Dave. The question pops into my mind that if all of the parties agreed to this 16 years ago and they all agree to something now, what drives you to believe them?
Well, it's easy and justified to be cynical. And I don't blame anybody who is. But we never give up. We are used to this being an uphill battle. It was an uphill battle getting the law passed. It was an uphill battle to get whatever progress we have gotten, and there has been some. And we know it's going to be an uphill battle to get the rest of the way. But that doesn't stop us. The fact is, if they don't make promises, it will be harder to deal with the next government, whoever they are. If they do make these commitments, then we're equipped to be able to go back to them after the election and try to hold them to account. And if they do it, we'll congratulate them. And if we don't, I'll be asking you to invite me back on your program.
And you know, it should be more of a priority. We know the demographics of our province, David. We know that we are getting older. We know that we are, even those of us who don't face those barriers right now, it's a reasonably good bet to think some of us will very soon.
Listen, the reality is it's bad policy and it's bad politics. Everybody either has a disability now, I've had mine for years, being blind, or they're going to get one later in life as they get older. We are the minority of everyone. And I don't know a politician who can last super long ignoring the needs of the minority of everyone. Now, what's going on right now? I know we're all sort of election fatigued, the federal election's over, but you know what? Candidates are already knocking on your doors right now, getting ready for next spring's election. So if they come to your door, ask them, what are you going to do to make Ontario accessible? We've delivered an accessibility plan for Ontario to all the parties. Ask them to sign on to it. And if you want to know more, our website is www.aodaalliance.org. And it'll be right up there for you to see what the plan is.
It's so hard to get this issue out front, David, because, well, let's look at the situation we're in. We're 6 months away from an election. We have COVID-19. We have environmental issues. We have new highways. We have all kinds of things. It's hard to keep it on the radar.
That's been a challenge for us. But you know what? On each of those kind of issues, we could fit in. COVID-19, people with disabilities have been disproportionately hurt by COVID-19. And the Ford government solution was to allow a protocol to be put in place in all of our hospitals that if they get overrun, some of the people who will be refused critical care if they're overloaded will be patients defined by their disabilities. That's in the There's blatant disability discrimination in that protocol. That's a new barrier that the Ford government allowed to be created on their watch. We're asking the next government, whichever, to fix that. But Doug Ford can fix it now with the stroke of a pen.
David, thanks for your time today, as usual.
Thanks so much for having me on, and stay safe.
David Leposky is the chair of the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act Alliance. 2005 was when the initial bill was passed, and the idea was within 20 years, right? I'm with Dave on that one. That seems like a longer time than you need, but sometimes you take what you can get. That within 20 years, the province would be fully accessible to all those with disabilities, and that's not the case. So don't think, of course, of just someone who has some mobility issues and maybe needs a ramp or needs whatever the automatic door opening. There are a variety of different issues that affect mobility. You can't just think about that, but just that lack of access to things that all of us who are able-bodied, able-minded are all able to take advantage of because we can. And the 20 years seems like, you know what, that's a good time frame. You can get your stuff done within 20 years. Apparently they couldn't. And it's not just the Ford government. It is previous governments before that, because that goes back to 2005. And the Ford government's only been in power since 2018, so they can take the blame for what they have done or not done since then. Like many other things during our almost 2 years of pandemic-y stuff, some things get pushed off to the side, perhaps understandably so. But they are asking for a new commitment from all of the parties to come up with a plan that would bring that accessibility up to date. I guess at this point, as soon as possible is the number you're asking, because, well, they already had one date, and that one doesn't appear to be going anywhere. *570-570-2545, 1-800-570-5715. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
We've said to the parties, we are devastated that what we were promised is not being delivered. And we want to know your plan to fix this up, to get us as close as you can to accessibility by 2025, and to get us to the promised land that we were promised as soon after that as we can.
David Leposky, the chair of the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act Alliance. They have written to all of the party leaders in the province, because you can't get your provincial election campaign started too early. Ask any of the parties, since they've been deeply involved for more than a few weeks now. Of course, the election is not until June, but they've asked each of the parties to come up with that plan on how they will actually put into place what is supposed to be in place by 2025. That's what the original legislation passed unanimously in 2005 by all the parties, which called for Ontario to be fully accessible by 2025. Dave Leposky says, well, probably can't make it now. So what commitments are you willing to make? Although they made a commitment when they voted before. So I'm wondering if perhaps it's a sensible idea to believe whatever commitment they might be making now. Perhaps not. But with all the other issues that are out there, and they are many, it is hard to keep any one particular issue up to the top of the list. And David says it's not a money issue completely, so it's more like anything else, a political will issue. But as we get older, you know, many of us will suffer some level of disability, which will make our access to things more difficult. It should be closer to the top of the page, but not everything that needs to be at the top of the page ever sees that part of the paper. Still to come this afternoon, Jim Stewart will join us from the Waterloo Region Health Coalition. The Ford government is in the midst of providing, or at least putting together, a system to get more long-term care beds in the province. We've certainly heard about long-term care for a long time. They are putting together 30-year capital funding deals, which will have licenses for 30,000 new long-term care beds and upgrading thousands more of outdated long-term care beds. And of the 30,000, right now it appears that about 16,000 are going to go to for-profit homes and 14,000 will go to nonprofit and municipal homes. And we know that the for-profit homes have not had, in many cases, quite the stellar reputation that you would have wanted when it comes to our long-term care issues. And again, it's another one of those issues that will touch all of us in one way or the other, whether it's us having to go into one of those facilities or a relative or a friend. It will hit all of us at one point or another, perhaps just remotely, but it will still be there. Shortly after 2, we'll hear from Dr. Kieran Moore. He is the Chief Medical Officer of Health for Ontario, as you have heard across most of our newscasts today. The expectation is the Ford government will expand eligibility for the next booster shot to those over the age of 50. So we expect to go live to Dr. Moore at 2 this afternoon. And Denise Young will join us just after 2:30. She is collecting what she calls blankets of love for the unsheltered. You know, all of us have probably more than a couple of extra blankets hanging around the house. I know we do. I think largely one or two or three are actually used by the cat more than anything else. And the cat's not going to miss it. It's going to be just fine. But maybe that could provide somebody else with a fair amount of warmth as winter begins to set in on us here. And, of course, we have Rangers tickets to give away. They are for Tuesday's game against the London Canigets. The London Canigets will play against the Rangers. It is the annual teddy bear game. So, as Paulie rightfully points out, BYOB, bring your own bear. Credit where credit is due. And it doesn't have to be a bear. Could be any kind of stuffed animal, I suppose. And then you heave it onto the ice in a wild display of misbehavior, which is always kind of fun. So we have tickets to give away at 2:45 this afternoon. I like to give you a heads up because the game can change every day. One never knows. I did make a small mistake yesterday because Brittany told me that there were going to be tickets to give away every Wednesday for the next few weeks. And then she added on the end of it also a couple of Thursdays. And I completely dismissed that. And I apologize. I wasn't. It was like we were married. I wasn't listening to her at all. It was really quite remarkable. So because of that, I've invited Brittany on to give us some piano tunings. So she will play a piano intro. You will name the song. Really simple. And ultimately, I get to decide who wins, because that's the way it works right here in this kingdom. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. As we approach the two-year anniversary of this pandemic, we remember that certainly long-term care became a major part of the conversation very early on into this process, if I can call it that, maybe perhaps March and April of that first year. And the discussion has continued. The Ford government's in the process of awarding 30-year capital funding deals and operational licenses for 30,000 new long-term care beds. They're also working on upgrading thousands of more beds that are outdated. And if it's a private business, for-profit, non-profit, or municipally run, they can all apply for the bed allocations. It appears that the privately run ones are getting, well, certainly more than half, and that raises some concerns. Jim Stewart is the chair of the Waterloo Region Health Coalition, joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Jim.
Good afternoon, Brian.
First of all, tell us a little bit about what the Waterloo Region Health Coalition is.
Well, the Waterloo Region Health Coalition is a chapter of the Ontario Health Coalition. And what we're all about is protecting and supporting our public health care system. I think you'd agree that almost all Canadians are in favor of a publicly run and publicly administered public health care system, not a private model similar to what they have in the United States.
What is the concern with the ratio of these long-term care beds?
Well, there's a number of concerns, Brian. I mean, it's quite complex, but just to be a little succinct here, because I know we don't have all day, the biggest issue is that the long-term care facilities, the long-term care operators that seem to do the worst in terms of being able to deliver care, especially during the pandemic, but also, quite frankly, well before the pandemic, are being rewarded for that terrible performance. Whereas the long-term care facilities that have done the best, the good performers, like the municipal-run public long-term care facilities, are not being rewarded at the same level. So there's a huge dichotomy amongst the number of rebuilt beds and new beds that are being divvied up between those two sectors.
Now, maybe I'm wrong in this, Jim, but it would strike me that perhaps the private sector model is able to move more quickly?
No, it's not about that at all. It's really all, it's about the fact that there's a funding mechanism that's provided to all long-term care operators, and that funding mechanism is being delivered in a kind of preferential way to the for-profit operators. So what you have to really understand here is that the public in Ontario, the taxpayers of Ontario, are paying for the delivery and the building of all of these rebuilt beds and new beds. So the long-term, the for-profit industry goes to the bank just like everybody else, and they get some money and they build these facilities. However, the great aspect to what's happening right now in the legislation is that they will receive 30-year contracts and 30-year operational budgets to pay for these long-term care facilities. So we're basically paying for them, and at the end of the build, they get to keep them. They keep all of the infrastructure. It's a massive transfer of public money to private ownership. If you want to think of something that was similar to that, think of the 407. And the efficiency delivered there in terms of the cost to drive on that road.
Is it even possible, though, Jim, to deliver this number of beds without some work from the private sector?
Well, we can have work from the private sector, of course. You can deliver these beds with work from the private sector. However, the beds should be established in a not-for-profit reality. It should be not-for-profit long-term care, because we know from a myriad of different studies and reports, the military report, the Canadian Association of Physicians put out a CMAJ, report on all the homes during the pandemic. And we know clearly that the not-for-profit home model delivered the best quality of care. And that's been reinforced many times over.
So is it a problem with the way these beds are being hired? Is it a problem in general that we maybe shouldn't have for-profit long-term care homes? What's the solution here if we're going to deliver these badly needed facilities?
Well, you know, you're right. There is a problem in the way they're operated, because what we've seen with the for-profit long-term care industry is that they're very focused on profitability, obviously. And so how they get there is they have a very low-cost labor model. So they're paying their PSWs, who provide the majority of care in these facilities, at an incredibly low rate, you know, about $15 to $16 an hour on average in this region. Now, there's been a little bit of a temporary top-up from the Ford administration, but the reality is that the employers themselves are paying very low wages. There's no hope of any kind of full-time work, so they keep everybody there, almost everybody on part-time employment, you know, without benefits, et cetera. There's no future. And so consequently, what you see is an exodus of labor from these for-profit long-term care facilities. So they can't keep anybody there because it's an incredibly tough job. And if you're not rewarded sufficiently, if you don't have any hope of full-time work, and if you're treated poorly, because many of the unions who are sort of managing these people are telling us that's how they feel about their employment, then they just leave. So if there's no care, there's no people, there's no care. It's as simple as that.
So I guess the question is there any hope of stopping this or at least changing it? Because this has a life of its own right now.
Yeah, there's very little hope of changing this right now. I think the only hope we're going to see is in the upcoming election in 6 months, because the government of Ontario under Mr. Ford, they rushed through this legislation in lightning speed, In fact, today is the day it's going to its final and third reading. Most people in the province haven't even heard of Bill 37 and what it does. They've never read the act that says, you know, no longer is it going to be just not-for-profit long-term care. It's now going to be not-for-profit long-term care and this thinly disguised wording of mission-driven organizations. They don't even have the courage to come out and say for-profit long-term care. They're trying to sort of, you know, use stealth wording to get this privatization by stealth completed. And that's happening without really adequate time for public consultation. They gave us one day to apply for standing and submit information to the committee that was looking at this. And it was only 10 hours of public consultation in total over 2 days. And that all happened just last week. So, quite frankly, I think if the public of Ontario is aware of what's happening, they would be outraged the way we are.
The Ford government has been in power since 2018, but I know you talked about, you know, we can speak with our vote in June, but the other parties aren't blameless on this either. They have, in many cases, ignored the same problems over the years. So who do we vote for, Jim?
Well, I think, quite frankly, obviously, they've been in power for long enough for them to start taking ownership of the actual reality of what's happening in Ontario now. For them,
yeah, this one sits on their plate, Jim. I don't disagree with that at all. That once you've been in power for 3 years, it's all yours.
Yeah. I mean, how long do we give them?
But my question is, if we have other parties as an alternative, the Liberal Party prior to this wasn't doing enough either.
Well, the Liberal Party is the one that brought through from my understanding, the Liberal Party is the one that brought through the 2007 legislation, which says clearly in the preamble of that legislation that long-term care would be delivered in a not-for-profit model. So, you know, if you want to talk about and compare how these different parties are doing, you know, that seems pretty black and white to me.
I just want to hold them all accountable, Jim.
Pardon?
Like, in all honesty, I just want to hold them all accountable. I just want whoever comes in to do the right thing.
Well, that's right. And the right thing is really pretty easy. Pass some legislation that says it should be not-for-profit. Pass some more legislation that says we should have a standard of care of minimum of 4 hours of hands-on care per resident. That standard of care has been requested for almost 19 years now. Pass those two pieces of legislation and you fulfill most of those requirements. So you don't have all the profits going to shareholders. You've got the money being reinvested in the long-term care facilities themselves, and you've got an adequate workforce of full-time employees delivering the care. That doesn't seem like rocket science to us.
But if you have that standard of care, Jim, and maybe even more importantly, if you enforce that standard of care and the guidelines that need to be in place, do you really need to have it as simply a non-profit exercise? Can we not do this with expectations and regulation?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up the regulations and the expectations, because that's another big part of this jigsaw puzzle. So what you need to do is you need to reinstate the surprise RQIs, that's the regular inspections of these homes that are done in a surprise fashion so that we can actually see how well they're performing. And then you can start to apply, you know, some penalties like fines that are already in the existing legislation that were never applied to any of these facilities, especially these for-profit facilities that provided such negligent care. We're talking about people who are dying from dehydration and starvation as the military, and in terrible unhygienic situations as the military reports and everyone else has, you know, is being faithfully reporting. So, yeah, I mean, we can hold them accountable.
Jim, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for your interest. We appreciate it.
And Jim Seward is the chair of the Waterloo Region Health Coalition, which is not exactly as nonpartisan as you might think, but that's fine. The real question may come out over this on whether or not it should be a for-profit or a not-profit. Can you do it by saying these are the standards of care, this is how this will be enforced, and this is what you will be punished with if those things are not provided. That seems like it's possible, but is there the will to do it? Well, that's an entirely different question. And moving to a completely not-for-profit system, that's going to cost some money too, because you've got for-profit homes that will expect to be compensated for the monies that they have spent. I, in my head, I think you can do it with regulation and expectations, but I'm not sure that that's true. Jody, go ahead.
Hi, I was just thinking after listening to your conversation with that gentleman that we need long-term care stuff now, places now to go for aging people and stuff like that. I see some of them in the community that look so lonely that could really use some help, and I feel so sorry for, you know, that I really wish I could help, but I'm a low-income person myself. Like, I'm 45 years old right now, and I'm worried about when I age, like, what's going to be out there for me. You know, I feel tired right now enough as it is. Never mind if I'm 72 either, right?
Yeah.
And it's just really sad that we're waiting they're waiting so long to offer these long-term care places to aging people, especially, you know, and people like me that, you know, need somewhere to go and some care, you know, because we're aging.
Thanks, Jody. Appreciate it. Well, it does take time to build these things. However, the reality is that the demographics have told us the same thing for years. We are going to get older. More of us are going to need to be in these places. And it was largely left over there. And then I still believe that there is this wanting to hide sometimes those who need that kind of care, whether it's for age or another reason, push them away because we don't like to think about it. We don't like to think about our ultimate demise. We don't like to think about what it might be like in 20, 30, or 40 years for each of us. We just don't really like to think about that. We all think we're going to live forever and be immortal and be constantly able to take care of ourselves. In the meantime, we have a healthcare system, and obviously it doesn't cover everything. But if you know, if you need some help at a certain age when you're younger, there's a lot of help there. When you get to the other end of the spectrum, all of a sudden it becomes a lot more expensive. And maybe we need to have a bigger discussion about that. And why do we have this private and non-profit split at the long-term care retirement area? Maybe, I'm not saying that we need to go completely to the non-profit model, because I think both of them can deliver, but you certainly have to have some parameters in place, and maybe those parameters are missing, and the willingness to enforce them seems to be certainly missing. Star 570-570-2545, 1-800-570-5715. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
They will receive 30-year contracts and 30-year operational budgets to pay for these long-term care facilities. So we're basically paying for them, and at the end of the build, they get to keep them. They keep all of the infrastructure. It's a massive transfer of public money to private ownership.
Jim Stewart, the chair of the Waterloo Region Health Coalition. Now, transfers of government money to private ownership. Nothing particularly new, but as this is in the long-term care area, it gets a little bit more attention, well, a lot bit more attention, based on what's happened over the last 2 years. Gordon, go ahead.
Hey, Brian. First of all, I agree with you about one size does not fit all. There has to be a myriad of options out there. To the 45-year-old that said about the about all the old people out there she sees and there's not room for them. A lot of people, especially like my mother, was a very private person and didn't want to go into a home care or into a home. She wanted home care, and that's what she got, and we paid for it. Okay, the government subsidized it somewhat, but we paid for it. As for this guy saying that all private home care facilities are bad, at least that's the impression I got from him. Okay, we and I'll mention a name. My father-in-law went into Chartwell, okay? Had a great 3 years in there. But the big thing that I find is families don't come, or people don't come and visit them, the elderly, enough, okay? We had a regular routine, a regular schedule. Our family went and visited my father-in-law at least every other day to make sure he was getting the care that he should get, okay? And that's a big issue.
Yeah, and I don't know, Gord, if that's maybe because we, I don't know, like I said before, we tend to push away the elderly. Let's put them over there because we don't want to see our own mortality, maybe.
I don't know, Brian. I just know that, hey, they're family. So why do you stop seeing them when they go into a home? You got to be in there, and you got to monitor their home care. You can't blame, you know, the people in there. You, maybe you can personally, but you got to take responsibility for the care of your loved one.
Yeah, you certainly have a role to play. Thanks, Gord. I appreciate the call. And to your point that not all for-profit long-term cares are horrible, here are the statistics. For-profit long-term care homes averaged 7.3 deaths per 100 beds during the pandemic. Nonprofit homes averaged 3.8 per 100. Municipal homes averaged 1.5. And that's all simple mathematics. Yet, on the other hand, we're talking about very individualized situations. You know, depending on the age of the people involved, whatever their conditions might be, that could certainly change from home to home to home. So that shows you something. It doesn't show you everything. And yeah, I know, Gord, and I've heard that the same thing from other people, and certainly my wife heads out every week and takes the dog out for visits to a couple places here in the region, and certainly she has talked to people who have told her that, you know, having somebody visit, even if it's somebody who's just there with their dog, makes a world of difference because it just lifts them out of that loneliness. I know it's something we don't particularly like to talk about, but it is out there, and we can do a little bit more in some cases. Gord's got a really good point, though. We are also partially responsible for the care that is received. Not that you're going to change everything, but being visible, I think, makes an awful lot of difference sometimes, too. If you are around, it can make a big difference. I do believe there needs to be a standard of care, and I believe there needs to be, there shouldn't be in this world an inspection. You'd think that everybody would want to do the right things, but that's not always the case. So regulation, inspection, and enforcement would go a long way because it is not going to happen in 2, 3, 4, 5, or maybe even 10 years, that everything goes over to the not-for-profit side. In fact, it's unlikely to happen at all. But if everybody has to provide the same standard of care, and everybody is subject to the same regulations, and the same kind of enforcement, then I think you're at least traveling down the path. It's not going to make it any less expensive, because it is going to cost a lot of money. It is a very tough job for those who work as PSWs in those places. They're tough, not only mentally, but physically as well. So you kind of understand why there's a significant amount of turnover in a lot of places. Money will not solve everything. It may keep some, and that's a good thing, but it won't keep everybody because it's a really, really, really tough job. It involves a great deal of physical strain and a great deal of mental strain because you get to know people and things happen and all of that comes together. Coming up a little bit later on this afternoon at 2:30, Denise Young, who is exceedingly nervous to be on the radio, but that's fine. I'll be nice. She is collecting blankets of love for the unsheltered. And when my wife and I began to talk about this the other night, we realized just how many extra blankets we actually have. They're not all piled on the bed like the princess and the pea here. They're just kind of spread around. There's another one. And of course, they are, as I said before, largely taken over by the cat, because that's what's happened. But Denise is looking for some donations to help out those who maybe don't even have one blanket this winter. And around 2:45 or so, we will give away tickets to the Rangers game against the London Canigets. That is next week. It's the annual teddy bear game. And you'll get to hear Brittany play the piano. And she is she's better than I thought. I was quite impressed. This is Kitchener Today on Sydney News 570. Today, producer Brittany said that Dr. Kieran Moore, he's no Doug Ford. And she's darn right about that, because Dr. Kieran Moore, Chief Medical Officer of Health for the province, is actually on time. So let's go to him.
I wanted to begin by acknowledging that earlier this week, we reported the 10,000th death from COVID-19 in Ontario. This number represents loved ones, families, friends, and co-workers. It's a stark reminder of the toll that this pandemic has taken on our province, on our communities. I want to extend my deepest sympathies and condolences to all those that are grieving. And thank you to all those health care workers that provided care to these individuals and those that continue to try to prevent this disease by working at immunization centers, assessment centers, and also continuing to provide care. In the last few weeks, we've seen our case counts increase with flare-ups in various regions across the province, and the highest rates of transmission are occurring in our north. I want to thank our local public health agencies for their continued commitment to protecting the health and well-being of their populations and for implementing additional public health and workplace safety measures as needed in response to any rise in cases. On a positive note, Ontario still has one of the lowest weekly case rates in the country, and our hospitalization and ICU occupancy remain stable. And our vaccination rollout continues to be steady and strong. Sur une note positive, l'Ontario a encore l'un des taux de casse hebdomadaire les plus bas au pays et le nombre de patients hospitalisés et aux soins intensifs demeure stable. Et notre campagne de vaccination continue d'une manière régulière et forte. We have officially hit our 90% first dose milestone for those 12 years of age and over, and 87.2% have received their second dose. And within the first 4 days of our campaign launch for those between 5 and 11 years of age, we achieved 6.4% of the population, and today we have already reached 12.3%. I want to take this opportunity to reaffirm that the recommended interval between the vaccine doses for the 5 to 11 year age group is 8 weeks for optimal, long-lasting protection. So please keep that in mind when you're booking your child's second dose appointment. I want to say a big thank you to all those kids out there who got their first shot and who have an appointment to get their second. It has been heartwarming to see the images of our young children rolling up their sleeves and doing their part to bring an end to this pandemic. As we continue our vaccine rollout of first and second doses, I am pleased also to announce that we are expanding our COVID-19 vaccine booster dose eligibility. Beginning Monday, December 13th, individuals aged 50 and over will be eligible to schedule their booster dose appointment. In addition, effectively immediately, individuals receiving dialysis are eligible for a third dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Alors que nous continuons notre campagne de vaccination pour les premières et deuxièmes doses, je suis heureux d'annoncer que nous étendons l'admissibilité de la troisième dose du vaccin contre la COVID-19 dès le lundi 13 décembre. Les individus âgés de 50 ans et plus seront admissibles à prendre un rendez-vous pour recevoir leur troisième dose. De plus, en vigueur immédiatement, les individus qui reçoivent un traitement de dialyse sont admissibles à une troisième dose de vaccin anti-COVID. Beginning in January, Ontario will further expand eligibility for booster doses based on age and risk with an interval of 6 to 8 months from the second dose. We are also recommending revaccination with a COVID-19 vaccine series post-transplantation for individuals who receive hematopoietic stem cell transplants, hematopoietic cell transplants, and recipients of CAR T cell therapy due to loss of immunity following therapy or transplant. Optimum timing for eligible re-immunization should be determined on a case-by-case basis in consultation with your clinical team. In regards to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the province is also making a single-dose J&J viral vector COVID-19 vaccine available to individuals age 18 and over who have not yet been vaccinated, or for those who have an allergy or contraindication to the mRNA vaccine. La Provence rend également le vaccin contre la COVID-19 à une dose de Johnson & Johnson disponible aux individus âgés de 18 ans et plus qui n'ont pas encore été vaccinés ou pour ceux qui ont une allergie ou une contre-indication au vaccin à ARNm. Individuals may request this vaccine by contacting their public health unit. For Omicron, finally, I know many of you have been following the news regarding the recently identified Omicron variant. There are 5 cases of this variant confirmed in Ontario, and additional cases will be likely identified in the near future. There continues to be evolving information on the variant's transmissibility, its severity, and its impact on the vaccine effectiveness, and we continue to closely monitor the situation globally and in Ontario. We are fully prepared to adjust our testing, our case and contact management, our vaccinations, our hospital capacity, and public health measures as needed to respond to any new threat. I also want to remind Ontarians that if you have returned from any of the 10 countries identified by the federal government as a country of concern, you are required to get a COVID test following the guidance and remain in quarantine for the remainder of the 14 days from the date of your entry into Canada, even if your test result is negative. Remember that when you're in quarantine, you should not be leaving your place of isolation and should avoid contact with those who did not travel with you. We also ask that you advise all your close contacts that they should be tested for COVID-19. The Omicron variant reminds us that the COVID-19 pandemic is far from over. We must remain cautious and humble in the face of this virus. But I do want us all to remain calm, to follow the science, follow best evidence, and we will continue to follow the epidemiology. We have a tough winter ahead of us, but by going back to the basics that have done us so well over the last 20 months, continue to wear your mask, wash your hands, practice physical distancing, stay home when you're sick, get tested if you have symptoms compatible with COVID-19, and limit the size of and number of social contacts. We can, together, by practicing these basics, limit the spread of a new variant or the current Delta variant. The most important thing you can do right now as well, if you haven't already, is step forward and get your COVID-19 shot, your first, second, or third dose, if you're eligible. Thank you, and merci. Happy to take questions.
We'll go to the phone lines. Just a reminder, one question, one follow-up.
We'll take a break, come back, and hear those questions and answers. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Head back to hear from the Chief Medical Officer of Health for Ontario, Dr. Kieran Moore.
Your first question comes from Anthony Fury with Post Media. Please go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Moore. I'd like to ask you about the tracking of incidental COVID hospitalizations. We know from a Public Health Agency of Canada report that a significant number of kids' hospitalizations are considered incidental, meaning they're in hospital for like a broken arm or something and then just happen to test positive asymptomatically for COVID upon admission but weren't suffering from COVID. But there's been no report or formal data on the degree to which this is or is not happening in the adult population. Do you know what percentage of adult hospitalizations in Ontario are considered incidental?
I don't at present. We can try to get that data for you, Anthony. It is important to know that if you're getting admitted to hospital, you will be screened for signs or symptoms of COVID. If you have any clinical indication, testing will be done. In many hospitals, especially if they're high risk in the community, all admitted patients get tested for COVID-19 just to ensure that we know their status and that we don't have any spread of the virus in the hospital. But we can try to get you that exact number.
Great. Thank you, Doctor. As a follow-up, I know you've previously said that now you're looking at hospitalizations as sort of a key indicator to guide policymakers in their decisions as opposed to cases. Are you working to getting sort of better incidental data then, if this is sort of COVID hospitalizations the key metric that you're using right now in your decision-making?
Yeah, so as I was saying, I'm very confident in the testing of adults and any patient getting admitted to a hospital. There are standards that are being held, as well as infection prevention and control. I'm certainly confident in the data that comes from our intensive care units. Clearly, that is one of the most important indicators. We get that aggregated at a daily basis and broken down by severity of illness. If there are incidental cases, they would be admitted to the general area of the hospital unless they deteriorate, but we would capture it on the ICU numbers. So our focus on the impact on the intensive care unit numbers remains steadfast. Today, I think we're at 155 with three patients from Saskatchewan. So that number has been remaining relatively stable in the 140 to 160 range for us, and we're monitoring that very closely to have both local public health measures put in place regionally and or provincial if necessary.
Next question. Your next question comes from Adrian Gobriel with City News. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Dr. Moore. This week on City News, we've been documenting how people have been using the templates of the old vaccine certificates, the ones without the QR codes, and how they've been creating counterfeit and fake certificates, whether it's Photoshop. Yesterday I spoke with a young adult who shows me how teens and young millennials are using Snapchat to erase the name, erase the date, and put in a name and date that matches the ID that they have in their pocket. You previously said if you hear of more cases of forgery when it comes to the vaccine certificate program, you would recommend to the government to phase out the old pre-QR code certificates. Have you had that conversation yet with the Premier and with the government? If you have, what has the response been? And if you haven't, why not?
So thank you, Adrian. This is an issue that clearly is disconcerting to me. It's important that anyone that's creating fraud realize that there are penalties associated with this. There's the penalty for financial fines up to $100,000, as well as 1 year in jail. So this is not being treated lightly by this government. We've also done investigations of workplaces and, for example, restaurants with multiple different teams that would include Alcohol Gaming Commission, the Ministry of Labor, as well as municipal bylaw officers, to ensure that the validation process is being put in play in businesses. I'm happy to report that 98% have been using the verification processes appropriately from our feedback from those task forces that have been trying to investigate and ensure that the verification process is in play. We are advising the government on this issue by collecting this type of data. Very happy with the implementation of the QR code reading and the verification process in general. If we do hear more, we have advised government if we hear of more fraudulent activity that we'd have to move from the progressive enforcement to the fines to show that this is being implemented to best protect our communities, to best protect and limit the spread of this virus and keep our businesses open. And we would advise moving to the QR code if we have as the main means of reading, as this will have the most likely decrease in risk for forfeiture of that signal. So we have advised government. We're monitoring it closely, and it is an important component of our adherence to best practices.
Follow-up?
Thanks for that, Dr. Moore. A question for my colleague, Cynthia Mulligan, with the announcement around boosters today. The CDC is recommending all adults over 18 get a third dose. Why aren't you recommending that?
So we are monitoring, as you know, we've had a great rollout of the 5 to 11 year age group. And to me, 12.3% today is a fantastic number. And I want to thank all parents and children that have come forward. We have a specific capacity to immunize in Ontario. We absolutely want those that are currently eligible to continue to come forward. So those that are over 70, and today we have over 20% have come forward and got their third dose boosters. And also First Nations, Inuit, Métis members of our community, those that are immune-suppressed or transplant patients, and healthcare workers. We built capacity to ensure over the next 2 weeks that those individuals could come forward together with the 5 to 11-year-olds and be able to get their third doses. And this is a call to arms for those age groups. I really want the over 70s in particular to come forward, as we know they're most at risk for waning immunity, fading immunity, and a risk for transmission. In these next 10 days, if you get your booster, you'll be well protected for the holiday season, and children will get the maximum benefit being immunized in the next 10 days for the holiday season as well by getting their first doses. So to me, these next 10 days, we built capacity to ensure that those populations have opportunity to get immunized. We then built capacity for the next most vulnerable group, the over 60 and over 50s, on the 13th. We'll monitor the volume of individuals that come forward for their first, for their third doses, and the overall capacity of the system, which is over 100,000 right now. And yesterday we had 67,000 people immunized, so a real call to arms. If we don't see the capacity being used that we've built to best protect those staged and phased high priority groups, we will then potentially open it up sooner to other age groups, but we'll always be in consultation with our Ontario Immunization Advisory Committee. We'll always follow the best science and guidance, and I do believe we'll be hearing from our federal partners on their recommendations on boosters in the coming days as well, which will only further guide further boosters. I also want to assure Ontarians that we're monitoring the immune benefit at a population level from these vaccines, and at 8 months out, for the general population, so 50 and less, we are seeing ongoing good immunity, but we want to be able to provide the third doses in a timely fashion before the immunity fades, especially as we're seeing an increase in cases related to Delta and the potential threat of Omicron to our communities as well. So I hope you're seeing that it is evidence-based, it's staged and phased based on our capacity to immunize in Ontario, but we absolutely will be following the science and opening up third doses if the capacity isn't being used, and following best science.
Next question.
Your next question comes from Laura Stone with the Globe and Mail. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Dr. Moore. I just wanted to follow up on that. You're talking about capacity. So what exactly what are you concerned about, that there's not enough people that would be available to administer vaccine? Are you talking about the system being somehow overwhelmed if you open it up to 18 plus? And is there also a supply issue that you're talking about here, that we don't have the supply to open it up to all adults at this time?
Yeah, well, it is complex, and as you know, we have over 7 million influenza doses that we've ordered for Ontarians. Our pharmacy partners, primary care partners, and mass clinics are providing both influenza immunization and COVID immunization, and we don't want to overwhelm a finite system, and our hospital partners are administering, and pharmacy partners. So we've built capacity to provide the influenza vaccine. We do anticipate the number of doses being provided to influenza slowing down in the coming weeks, which will increase capacity again for further COVID vaccination. All of this is being timed to best protect our communities and follow best evidence. We have ample supply of vaccine. We have actually ample supply of influenza vaccine too, so I'm calling on individuals to get influenza immunized as well. there are some limitations on the throughput because of that immunization for influenza as well as COVID, as well as prioritizing 5 to 11s and the five main groups that have already discussed, First Nations, Inuit, Métis, over 70, immune-suppressed, transplant patients, those that received AZ, two doses, and one dose J&J product, and, of course, our healthcare workers. So we are opening it up. I think there's be over 5.3 million people eligible with the announcement today who 6 months after their last dose can get their third dose. We don't want people booking months ahead. We would like to be able to make just-in-time delivery of the vaccines following capacity and ensure we offer timely access when we have capacity and not having to rebook when we've built or find extra capacity in the system.
Chief Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Kieran Moore, at his media briefing today in Toronto as Ontario expands vaccine booster eligibility to anyone over the age of 50, expected to start by the middle of this month, although that could be speeded up. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words saying. Only the echoes of my mind.
Just news coming across now that sportscaster Brian Williams has announced his retirement. 50 years. Quitter. That's who you are, Brian Williams. 50 years in the sports broadcasting business. Did his first Olympic Games in 1976. Probably had a chance to interview Baron de Coubertin. If you don't know your Olympic history, look it up. It is December, and that means all kinds of good things are going on out there. People doing all kinds of good things for people. And that is certainly nice to see. Next week, we'll talk to the people from the Toasty Toes campaign. Today, we'll maybe try to warm up more of the body than just the toes. Denise Young lives in Waterloo, joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Denise.
Hi, Brian. Good afternoon.
Tell me about your blankets of love. Tell me more.
Well, I believe, Brian, that everyone has a story and we all go through difficult chapters. And I think everybody needs a blanket of love. We need to feel the love. And we need to feel that warmth in the cold weather, especially the disadvantaged.
Well, I think almost every one of us, Denise, grew up with a favorite blanket, right?
Absolutely, yes. Mine was pink.
I think mine was just tattered and worn out, but I don't think I quite remember the color. So what have you been doing? You live in the Barrel Yards, I know that, and you've just asked the Barrel Yards community to collect blankets and bring them to you, right?
I've been asking everyone I know to bring some blankets to me. But I did start, the first people that I contacted were the wonderful people that live at the Barrel Yard. Fantastic community. Huge shout out to them. And that's how it started. I like to think that I have a team. I have a very good friend, Christopher Dye, and Brenda Rivard. And Christopher is my captain. Brenda's my assistant captain. And they are doing all the social media for me because I'm not very tech savvy. Anyone who's received an email from me knows that. And yeah, I'm just asking people to please donate blankets so that we can help the disadvantaged and that they may feel the blanket of love.
So how many blankets have you collected so far, Denise?
Well, I haven't kept count of them, but I will start. Thank you, Brian, for the tip. On Sunday morning, actually, at 2 a.m., I came up with this great idea. Ha ha. It is a wonderful idea.
That's when all the best ideas come, Denise, is Sunday morning at 2 a.m.
You're so right, Brian. And by Monday, I think I had 100 blankets.
That's kind of amazing. Except, I accept, and I think that we were talking about this earlier today, that every one of us has probably more than enough blankets because we save them for the cat and we just put them on over top of a couch and nobody ever actually uses them. So we've all got plenty, right?
Absolutely. You just have to look for them.
Now, if people would like to get involved and maybe give some of those blankets a good home, is there a way that we can do this?
Well, this Saturday, I will be outside of the barrel yards with my team. You will, anyone, everyone will recognize us because we will be wearing pink hats and pink scarves.
Okay.
And you won't be able to miss us, and we're going to be smiling through our masks. We'll have our masks on. We're trying to make this very safe. If people want to come over, drive over and bring us your blankets.
And it's a nice drive-through setup there, so you don't even have to get out of your car, really.
Brian, you nailed it. That is the plan. My team members will walk up to your car and say hello. You may hand them the blanket and then wave goodbye and thank you very much. Thank you for helping blanket people with the love.
A couple of different buildings there, Denise. You'll be in front of 16?
Correct, Brian.
And that's from 1 to 4 p.m.?
12 to 4. Can I say one? I'm sorry. I'm very nervous.
Well, you should be, because this is the region's 14th most popular talk show. So handful of people listening, so you should be nervous.
Honestly, Brian, I'm very nervous, but I am so honored and so excited. We live in such a generous community, but you know that better than anyone.
Yeah, I've had some experience with that. So what will you do with these blankets, Denise? Where will they be going?
Okay, I have already dropped off a cardboard bowl. I believe I did that on Tuesday night to the Working Center. Joe and Stephanie Mancini, in my opinion, are the salt of the earth, and they will find homes for these blankets. Ray of Hope will be receiving some, St. John's Soup Kitchen crew. You call me, you contact me, you need a blanket, I will bring you the blanket. Every blanket donated is going to have a home.
Those are great organizations, and you're right. Joe and Steph Mancini do such incredible work here, as do the people from Ray of Hope, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, okay, that's simple. Noon to 4. Is it noon or 1? Now you've got me confused. Noon?
Brian,
noon to four. Okay, sorry. Noon to 4, Saturday at the Barrel Yards, number 16. It's just right off Father David Bauer Drive. You can't really miss it. And my entire goal here, Denise, is to absolutely bury you in blankets.
Well, that, I couldn't be happier. That is exactly what I want to happen. I'm so impressed with everyone. And Brian, as you know by now, I'm a chatterbox. Could I please just make a few shout-outs?
Oh, well, yeah, well, I usually charge for those, but this time I'll let it happen.
I'll bake you a cake.
No, that's okay. You don't have to do that, Denise. So go ahead, give me a shout-out or two.
Okay, a shout-out or two. I have to make a shout-out to Joe and Stephanie Mancini, the St. John Soup Kitchen crew, the Ray of Hope crew, the Bridges crew, the CMHA Cambridge, the CMHA Kitchener, the CMHA Waterloo, Ruth, and the numerous volunteers who are in the shelters. The outreach workers, the fabulous peer support workers and volunteers in KW and Cambridge. And Brian, hey, you and I both know in KW and Cambridge, there are some incredible people who have, I may get in trouble for saying this, but very deep pockets, and they fly under the radar, and a lot of their donations that they very quietly make help so many. This is a fantastic community. I can't say enough about it, and obviously you figured that out.
All right, Denise, thank you very much. You know what? I wouldn't be surprised if some bagels showed up at your door in the next day or so.
Okay, that is wonderful. So KW, please, KW Cambridge, show up, bring those blankets, and let's keep the blanket of love going. Let's help those disadvantaged, the people that really need to feel the love in this COVID era we're living through.
All right, thanks, Denise. Appreciate your time today. That is Denise Young from Waterloo. Saturday, noon to 4, you can drop off blankets if you like at 16 Barrel Yards Boulevard. Relatively easy to get to, right off Father David Bauer Drive. In, out, done, make somebody warm. Come up on the other side, and we will give away Rangers tickets for a game against the London Knickets. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. All right, we've unblocked the lines. Now is the time for you to call. *570-570-2545, 1-800-570-5715. Two tickets to next week's game between the Kitchener Rangers and the London Canucks. It is the teddy bear game, so you get to toss stuffed animals on the ice. There's reason enough to go right there. Plus, the atmosphere between the Rangers and the Canucks is always pretty good, so well worth going to. I really can't believe, like, if you've ever wanted to win a radio contest, this is the moment. Where are all our Rangers fans this afternoon? There's one right there. Now, I have been promising this for weeks, ever since I regaled you with my guitar abilities a couple of weeks ago, that we had more people with musical talent here. So Brittany Bordelone, the executive producer of this program, has joined us. And you are a pianist.
I am a pianist, yes.
You're very good.
Thank you.
I know. Like you said, you'd send me some samples. I got to know, you probably don't even remember when you first started playing, do you?
No, it's been so long now.
Well, were you forced into the lessons? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
But then you stuck with it, which is good.
Yeah,
so you learned a few things. That's worthwhile.
Yeah. So, thought maybe I could be the next Alicia Keys or something like that. She plays a really good piano.
I can't believe that we managed to get this huge piano all the way up the stairs and in the studio.
No.
Well, we didn't do that, Paulie.
We didn't do that. Of course, Brittany was able to record it at home and send me the thing. So is it a Steinway?
Yeah.
It is. Right. Did you want to ask me the question?
What's a Steinway?
About 10 pounds. I'm sorry. That's such an old joke. It just had to be done.
Wow.
All right. So now do you play at what? Birthday parties? Bar mitzvahs?
Well, I'm a little too shy for that, Brian, but...
I
could be swayed into doing the odd birthday party every now and then.
You just regale your new husband, Derek.
Is that the name today?
That's today's name. So, and here's the other great thing: you didn't decide to do it with a festive theme. So, I'm happy with that.
Thank you.
We're just a little bit more back into the '70s and '80s rock and roll, which I thought was some pretty good choices there.
Got a phone call coming in.
Yeah, we do. There it is. And unlike that show, we started on time today.
That was a scandal last night.
Oh, it was terrible. Now, you should have... Look, my wife spends the entire hour tree beaving, swearing like a longshoreman anyways, but she was really letting it rip in the first 7 minutes last night. It was pretty impressive. Brian is our contestant. Brian, how are you?
Good day.
All right. Consider yourself an expert at some level in piano music intros?
No.
You don't believe in yourself, Brian. Who the hell else is going to believe in you?
I consider myself an expert at nothing.
Oh, good. Well, you can't disappoint yourself that way, so that's good.
That's right.
So here's the way this works. We have three piano intros.
Okay.
You're going to have to at least identify one of them.
Okay.
I'd like it to be the first, because it works better that way.
Okay, I'll try.
All right. But I'll give you three chances to... I'm basically giving you three chances to identify one piano intro.
And these are like any random song?
Well, there's three random songs that we're going to play for you. We'll play each one at a time, and then you identify the song. So I've made it very simple. In fact, I would say if I could create a word here, I've farwelled this baby.
It's like Name That Tune, right?
A little bit like Name That Tune, yeah. But except I'm not going to have you go on the notes. All right,
okay,
so let's play the first one, Paulie.
Brittany, hit it!
All right. Do you have any idea, Brian, what song that is?
Yeah, that's Crocodile Rock. Elton John.
Look at that.
We got a winner. We have a winner.
Very, very, very good. That's very good, Brittany. We're going to...
Sorry, I just got a funny text. That's all.
I don't think she takes my compliment seriously. I thought she was very good. Didn't you, Brian?
That was awesome, Brittany.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
so,
you.
Can we do the other two just so I can hear her play again?
As a matter of fact... Yes, we can, because I'd planned that, because I do need to kill a certain amount of time.
All right, bring it.
All right, Brian, which, by the way, doing very well, not surprising with that name.
If I get three for three, is there like a bonus prize? Like, will Brittany come and play at my house for a Christmas party?
Oh, she might. She might. We'll have to talk. All right.
Okay.
Let's play the second one.
Oh,
as an organ or something.
Well, no,
in there,
but obviously with keyboards these days, you can flip over to almost anything, which is one of the ones you have, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. Okay, Brian, do you know what this is? Of course you do.
I do. That's bloody well right.
Right.
We got a winner. We have a winner.
Why Supertramp? I didn't know you'd be a Superman, a Supertramp fan, but...
I don't consider myself a huge fan, but I know their music. I'm a child of the 70s like you.
So. Yeah. I'm surprised we remember anything from the 70s,
to be
honest.
I was in a department store with that one. In the sock aisle.
Men's pants, half off. Sorry, that's an old joke, too. Brian, we got a third one for you here. All right, here we go.
All right.
All right, Brian, any clue on that? Your child of the 70s, you should know this.
Yep, that's Lady Madonna, the Beatles.
It is Lady Madonna. And
we got a winner. We have a winner.
Considering the fact that you didn't know who all the members of the Beatles were, I'm kind of impressed that you could play that one. Not that I want to bring that up again, but I just did. Brian, you're a winner. You are going to the game between the Kitchener Rangers and the?
London Knights.
No, London Knigets. They must be called the Knigets. On this show. It's a Monty Python reference. If you don't know what it is, watch the Holy Grail.
And it's teddy bear night, too. Bring a
right.
stuffed animal.
Bring a lot of stuffed animals. All right. I'm going to put you on hold, Brian, and okay. We'll get all your information. No, before you run away, because I know it's your job to get the information, but that's really impressive. Will you come back again, and we'll make it more Christmassy themed?
Sure. Okay. Whatever you want, Brian. Right. It's your show. I'm just here
no,
for the party.
That's not true. And, okay, Polly?
Hey, Brittany, can you play the kazoo?
Ooh.
That might be interesting to identify songs on a kazoo.
I like that. I like that.
Listen, we have you up next for playing your songs on the triangle. Oh, so get ready.
That would be worth the challenge right there. We have a couple more weeks. You'll be surprised at how many things. Okay, go get Brian's information. He's a winner. He's going to see the Kitchener Rangers and the London Knigets face off at the auditorium on Teddy Bear Night. Please, if you're going to Teddy Bear Night, don't forget, bring some teddy bears. All right? That shouldn't be that difficult. So we are actually actively scouring this building, which is hard to do because there aren't that many people in here. But we're actively scouring the building for people who can play instruments. But that's, like, I'm an okay guitar player. Brittany's very talented. Like, that's incredible stuff there. Sounds like really just like the real thing. So down the road, we'll have her play some Christmas tunes. That'll be nice. And then now that we have a schedule that we know that every Wednesday we're going to be giving away tickets, every Wednesday and occasionally on Thursdays, which is as close as our promotions department gets to giving me a completely sensible schedule. Every Wednesday and occasionally on Thursdays, we'll have a new game for you to play. Well, we will repeat some old games. But I like the fact that we were able to highlight someone's talent. So we've been looking around. I can't remember who it was who told us they're able to play the trumpet. I think it might have been James. That James can play the trumpet. I'm not kidding on this. This is actually true that he can play the trumpet, but he doesn't have a trumpet. So that's going to be a bit of an issue. And apparently he can also play the clarinet. An announcement that didn't surprise me in any way whatsoever.
I'm sorry. I would think that if I could play an instrument, I would own one of those instruments.
Said instrument. I think it's from his high school days, and he's not that far removed from those, let's be honest. You know, so maybe he can go back to his alma mater and collect a trumpet. But I'm still on the hunt for a tuba or a euphonium. If I can find
a
euphonium, it's a fancy name for what they call a baritone. So okay. It's like a tuba you put in the dryer and it shrunk. That's basically what it is. I can play that. Because it's the same fingering patterns as a tuba.
All right.
And I can also play the trombone. Not well. Like,
No one's saying that you're win any awards here.
No. There's a guy on The Voice. He's one of a couple of guys and his son. And this guy can seriously play every instrument in the world.
Yeah, but who cares? It's The Voice.
I know, exactly. Probably
it's
shouldn't
not a talent
count.
Show. Are there instruments on The Voice in later rounds? I really don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't watched a full
season.
Yeah,
they use a band all the time.
Okay.
And even if you want to come up and play your own instrument, you can do that. So
all
I am on the hunt for a tuba, And, of course, I'm also encouraging listeners. I've had one listener already contact me and wants to send me some piano bits that she plays. So if you happen to play an instrument, that'd be cool.
Like she'll record it on her phone or something?
Yeah, that's all you need to do.
Yeah, I guess that works.
We don't care about the quality at all. It's not even important to us. Coming up tomorrow, we have no idea, but we do know it's Friday, which means from 2 to 3, it shall be up to thee to create some kind of programming. We're all working on a couple of different things that are out there as the landscape continues to shift. I will tell you, we're completely ignoring the baseball walkout, just simply because I know nothing's happening until January. They're not going to sit down and do any kind of negotiating now, are they, Paulie? You're a baseball fan. They're not going to talk now.
I hope they do. They got a couple of weeks till Christmas.
Yesterday's session was what, 7 minutes?
There was a meeting in the morning that was about 45 minutes, and then they came back with a smaller group in the afternoon, and yes, that meeting was 7 minutes.
It's funny how the tables have turned over the years, and people now actually trust the owners, I think, more than the players, which is ridiculous because it's a bunch of billionaires who don't care about you. They honestly don't. This is a business, kids. It's a business, just the same as the NHL is a business and everything else. Everybody's out to get theirs because that's what the capitalist system has created. Is that good or bad? Depends on you. Should anybody be paid $43 million to throw a baseball? Probably not, but Max Scherzer's going to be. So it's that simple. $43 million to throw a baseball. I have done it for considerably less, although their level of success may have dropped quite dramatically. Tomorrow, as I said, Free Phones Friday. Tonight, we'll be heading out to the theater. So we'll give you a bit of a review on that. And it's an honest review because I've told you I'm going, not particularly because I love Patsy Cline music, but I do kind of like live performances. And I'll tell you all about that. And those tickets are available from Drayton Entertainment. And if you weren't with us last night on playing Bingo with Burke, it was almost no Bingo with Burke because it was a good 7-8 minute gap there at the beginning.
Yeah, I tuned in right at 8, and there was a screen that said technical difficulties. Please stand by.
You know what was impressive, though? That David still got out on time, right?
I think he was a couple of minutes late, but given that they started 10 minutes late and they are only 2 minutes late at the end of it, yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Pretty professional.
Although, right, what was sacrificed was the trivia.
Yeah, that's
there
true.
There wasn't much trivia last night.
We had to pay a price somewhere. Back tomorrow from noon till 3. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.